Hi, everybody. My name is Maureen Bowden. I'm the director of AIM, the Immigrant Advice Network, and I just want to welcome you all, and thank you for coming. I'm really delighted you could make it. I would like to thank the board as well, and Alan, of course, for all their help for the preparation of this. So we're really excited about today. I think it's going to be a really interesting day, and we... One special feature today, actually, is it's not just the people in this room that we're aiming this at. We're also aiming it at our whole membership because we're podcasting. As of Monday, all the speeches and everything, all the presentations, are actually going to be available on our website. And so we know that all our global membership is going to be able to participate through doing that. So that's we're very excited about that innovation, and we're delighted that Brian Green is here to take care of that for us. For the morning session, Seamus Scally is going to be our moderator. Seamus is a Roscommon native, and he's the former General Secretary of the Labour Party. He was in the cabinet of Commissioner Dick Burke in Brussels for 5 years. He's a founding member of the Irish Centre in Birmingham, and he's also been on the board of AIN for many years, and he's certainly been a tremendous asset to our organization. So I'll just hand you over to him.
Thank you very much indeed, Noreen, for that introduction. Well, my first duty this morning is to welcome each and every one of you here. I know many of you have travelled long distances within the country, and Sheila Gleeson is here from the United States. And that's my cue for sort of welcoming all of those who will see our proceedings as they log in due course. They're in different parts of the world, the United States, Australia, in Africa, and elsewhere. And you're all very welcome. I've no doubt you'll be very interested in our proceedings this morning. You are our dear friends, and we welcome you from the Emerald Isle. Now, before we get down to the speakers, it has been suggested to me that it would be a good idea if each person in the room were just to give his or her name and the organisation and group to which they belong. So, as I'm a sort of a left-winger, I'll start on my left-hand side and start in the front row.
Coming from your same wing, Brian Green, I'm with Duke Design, and we're recording today for the Jasper.
Thank you, Brian.
Noreen Bowden,
whom you've heard.
Karen McHugh, involved in the Assisted Holiday Projects.
Thanks, Karen.
Peter Hammond from the London Irish Centre.
Thanks, Peter.
Mary Doyle from Castlebar Parish, representing Children's Diocese.
Mary, thanks.
John Hickey, Director of AIM.
Sheila Gleeson, Coalition of Irish Immigration Centres.
Thank you, Sheila.
Grainne Pryor, ICPO, Irish Commission for Prisons Overseas.
Grainne.
That's
McGarry
from Ballina Green and the Irish Times.
Kate Jackson from the Irish Commission for Prisoners Overseas.
Now, stay in the back row.
John Dye, Irish Democratic League of Great Britain, the husband of Deborah Grant. Thank you, Peter.
Thank you, John.
England.
Jim Carroll, Irish Abroad Unit.
Thanks, Jim.
David Gorman.
Thank you.
Elton Cowley.
Thanks, Elton.
Siobhan Gorman from Sandball Irish Society in the West of England.
Thank you, Siobhan.
Yvonne Flavio, Crosscare, Owen Valley, Crosscare Michael Project.
Attracted Heenan, Huddersfield,
Thank you.
Liam Ferry, Irish Immigrant Publications in Galway.
Thank you, and last but not least.
Michael Curran, Belfast, Irish Chapel, Salem, Trinity College.
Thank you, Michael. Now, ladies and gentlemen, the one person who didn't introduce himself, but I will do it now. He's our outgoing chairperson, Father Alan Hilliard. He's been with us for 4 years. He's been so innovative, so dynamic, so efficient, but you know all that when you hear him. Father Alan.
Thank you, Seamus, and it's good to see you all here, friends, and good to make contact with people on our podcast as well. Many phone calls yesterday for different reasons, and people quite excited by the fact they can hear what's going on today in their own centres across the world. be they more formal centres or just voluntary groups, because the one thing I find about the voluntary groups is they love to feel part of the bigger picture. Any visit is always welcomed, and that's so important to connect people with what's going on. Also, from the point of view of value for money, which we hear a lot about recently, it's a lot cheaper than flying people in from America and overseas, that they can access what the content at the heart of what we're saying, even if they want to edit it down. It's a much better emphasis for them. And also to mark the progress that has happened in the last few years is having Sheila Gleeson here, who's head of the Coalition of Irish Immigration Centres, that when we started this job, you had to be ringing all the centres in the United States. Now there's with the funding from Foreign Affairs and the interest of people, that now you can connect with one person and everything then gets mediated across the United States. So those networks have not to be taken for granted. They came about as a lot of hard work and effort, and knowing that Sheila will go back and distill in essence what's going on here is very, very important. Because I think one thing that we realised, a lot of lobbying went on over the years in immigrant centres abroad, but really the lobbying that went on at home here and that transferred into the hearts of Irish people became the force for change in attitudes to immigrants. And I know that when ministers, etc., visit abroad, immigrant groups get great time with them, but sometimes that doesn't translate into effective action for that community. But at least in Ireland now, there is a lot more consciousness of emigration, and indeed more consciousness of immigration. That's not to say there's more consciousness of migration. And I just want to present this paper to you, sort of reflecting on my 4 years with AIM, and just reflect on some of the issues that I think are pertinent to the future. And I suppose in November 2005, I posited that AIM, as with many of our affiliates, was not so much a service provider, but a learning organisation. And a learning organisation demands creativity, imagination, reflection, and serious deliberation. And I suppose as we hear more and more talk about outcomes and plans, the one thing about migration, it eludes the best plans, because it's about people and their needs and the way they're moving. Any organisation that serves immigrants and migrants in general, it's by its very nature, it's a learning organisation, because it has to be responsive not just to the immigrant, not just to the person moving, but to the many relationships that exist in society that are part and parcel of the immigrant agenda. And I suppose what's happened for us in the last 4 years, the need to identify and work with many organisations that are part of mainstream society, but have no direct commitment to immigrants. But however, when they are canvassed, we find that they are open to including the needs of immigrants. They don't have full-time people on their boards committed to this agenda, but when mentioned, they warm to it and they're open to it and they're delighted to have representation. And I suppose it's fair to say that today many nations are waking up to the political and monetary power of the diaspora. More and more countries are wanting to develop a strategic relationship with their people living abroad. Some, I suppose, wish to stay in touch with the diaspora to entice the best people back home. Reversing the brain drain is a key policy for a lot of countries. And if Ireland is to be a leader in this area, I think we've a lot more work to do. We've allowed circumstances of the past attract people back without actively putting strategic plans in place to bring people back. And I saw some people say, well, that's not true, because like for last year there was a fair in New York attracting people back on the basis of jobs here in Ireland. But that's really the folly of the whole world of migration, that, you know, we need a world that's focused on the migrant, not just on the work that a migrant can do in that country. Because tying any human being into their value in the labour market is no way really to evaluate the well-being of a person. I suppose none of us ever want to go back to the days in Ireland of unemployment, days when the town I loved so well saw men who walked the dogs and the women who went out to look for jobs. We cannot say, as I said already, that human well-being lies solely with a job. Human well-being has many indicators. Having a job is only one of them. And I suppose those among the undocumented population in the US have jobs, yet the insecurity they face at a daily level tears at their sense of well-being. And David, who's here with us, I met him in Washington last year when we were campaigning for the rights of the undocumented in the United States. And I suppose that lack of political outcome for all the undocumented in the United States is a disappointment for all of us. But it's only a shadow of the disappointment felt by those who are directly affected by this circumstance in America as they try to keep hope alive. I suppose We have focused on the issue of immigration reform over there, where maybe we should be studying the issue from a different angle, namely reform of the labour market. These people are working at jobs that contribute to the gross national product. The vast majority pay taxes. They're employed by American citizens who face a labour market shortage and a resulting loss of revenue should this supply of labour dry up. They employ undocumented people, benefiting from their work, yet they fail in their responsibilities to them. In 2005, a publication by the Californian Farm Bureau Federation said it estimated 70% of the state's seasonal farm workers were falsely documented. And I think the screw is beginning to turn now in the Department of Homeland Security. As they try to enforce immigration laws, states are reacting. In August in Illinois, the governor signed a law amending the state's Right to Privacy in the Workplace Act to prohibit employers from participating in the agency's voluntary electronic employment verification program, known as E-Verify. Then last month, a federal judge in California blocked an agency plan that would have given employers 90 days to reconcile employees' social security numbers that didn't match official records or be held accountable for hiring undocumented workers. And these measures are taken not to support or protect the undocumented, but to protect the business interests. Because the governors know that if they put the screws on the undocumented people, that there'd be nobody to work. And there's no doubt that many Irish have done well in the United States and enjoy many of the wonderful opportunities that are offered there. However, there's always been cohorts that somehow never got acknowledged. The Irish that dug the levees in New Orleans were given work in the place of slaves. The slave owner could not afford to let a slave die. A slave was a valuable asset, more valuable than the Irish who'd recently come off the boat. In the mind of the employer, the loss of an Irish person was preferable to the loss of a slave. And I suppose we're familiar with the words quoted on the Statue of Liberty. Give me your tired, your poor, your huddled masses, yearning to breathe free, the wretched refuse of your teeming shore. Send these, the homeless tempest tossed to me. I lift my lamp beside the golden door. I suppose present circumstances may relegate these words and indeed the Statue of Liberty represents to the status of Ellis Island, a historical record describing a past moment rather than a living reality. The nation of the United States manages its diversity by referring always to the right of the individual. At this stage, for anything to be achieved, we need to hear the voices of great individuals akin to Rosa Parks and the Civil Rights Movement. We need leadership from within to expose the injustices in a nation that claims to offer moral leadership to the world. And let us be in no doubt to the enormity of the challenge. The reality is, and I know this from talking to people last week, is that for every one supporter of reform, there are 1,000 anti-immigrant voices. At a migrants advocate conference last week in Mexico City, Alonso Flores is a member of the Institute of Mexicans in the Exterior, an agency of the Mexican government that fosters ties with Mexicans living abroad, estimates that 1 million Mexicans will be deported in the coming year from the United States as a result of new laws. Calderon, in a speech to the conference, said a new media campaign would change the distorted perceptions Americans have about Mexican workers and build consciousness of the many contributions they make for the society in which they work and live. Maybe this is the enlightened approach we need to make. Maybe we need not walk the corridors of power in the United States, but engage in a campaign to educate people about the reality of our undocumented Irish in the United States. This latest squall stimulated by Trina Vargo shows the need to have further mature discussion on the matter. Time can be spent arguing or time can be used more productively educating those that are in need of enlightened education programs that dispel myths. This is a challenge for all migration lobbyists. You cannot change political process and outcomes if you ignore the mindset of the people who actually vote. Mindset has a lot to do with the issue, and healthy perspectives need to be nurtured and developed. And there's none better than the Irish to implement such a program. There was a story of a guard who was out to catch a fella down in Kerry when he just newly arrived. He was trying to impose himself upon the community. And he tried everything. And the last occasion he had to put his stamp on this man and call him into line was he realised he had a load of dogs in the yard. So he set up on the bicycle at the top of the hill, watching for the moment when all the dogs were running wild about the yard. And he sped down the hill on the bicycle, straight into the yard, in which all the dogs started yelping at him and he couldn't get off the bike. And the farmer put his head out, Dinjo was his name, he says, "Well, guard, I'd love to come out to you, but you'd have to call your dogs off me." And I suppose that is, like, who defines legality? Which is the issue in this whole thing? And I mean, who puts those brand names on? Who puts those labels on? And I think in terms of migration generally, there needs to be a lot of education to dispel myths about the real issues behind the migration debates, like in the United States or even here. And I suppose this uncertainty and insecurity is more a mark of our future than we realise. As we study the plight of the Irish in the United States, we realise it's only a mirror of a growing reality. While we ask how we support the immigrants, countries are asking how do we get workers. And this has culminated in a growing acceptance of academics like Philip Legrand, who highlights the benefits of migration for the immigrant, the receiving country and the homeland. His views are admired among the business sector. However, he proposes the development of temporary worker programmes. Again, the focus here is on the labour market and not the migrant. Surely, as a country, and as organisations have a long history of dealing with immigration, we need to highlight the inadequacy of such theories. Our worker emigrants reveals when temporary is put alongside migrant worker, there are catastrophic consequences. Indeed, any talk of integration in countries where these conditions are present is shallow talk. The objective set out by AIM is to make emigration a positive experience. It can be precisely this when there is certainty, security and engagement with basic human rights. Whereas our focus is on the emigrant, it is worth noting that we are developing systems in Ireland whereby those coming to our country are finding themselves in circumstances that are far from secure. The establishment of contract labour allows the employer claim that they are at a distance from the low wages and inequitable conditions of those who are brought in from other countries by these agencies. I suppose all this serves as evidence that globalisation, whereas in itself is a good concept but may have undesirable outcomes, of creating a continuing crop of people such as the undocumented in the US that serve well but are themselves badly served. And I suppose, just to say at this point in time, all of us involved in the world of emigrant services have benefited greatly from the establishment of the Irish Abroad Unit. I welcome Jim Carroll here today, who's a faithful supporter of all that we do and always on hand to give guidance and assistance. And with the Irish Abroad Unit came the increase in government funding. And in our lobbying, we said if policy is right, funding will come, which has been true. And I suppose this has meant increased and not total security for those who are served and increased security for those who provide services. I suppose, though, for some immigrant communities, they've become a series of fiefdoms with an unenthusiastic regard for the larger debate regarding the definition and limits of diaspora policy. I suppose last May we had an initiative undertaken by the Department of Dublin Castle about the diaspora. And when it comes to the wire, there's not much of an imaginative response outside our own box of what we want for the diaspora. What is the relationship we want with our people abroad? And I've often heard immigrant communities referring to themselves as the 33rd county in Ireland. Even when I was in Bondi, referred to it as County Bondi. And this reminds me of a time in our history when what we had a fifth province in Ireland, Tara being the location that we're most familiar with. However, before the High Kings lived in Tara, they lived in Uignish, which is located in the heart of Westmeath in the Midlands, which I know there's great following from the Midlands here today. And it was believed to be the geographical centre of Ireland, that's why it was picked, and the place that articulated a vision for Ireland as it was then. It was more than a geographical location, it was a concept. It was the place to freely explore without worry of referencing sources or claiming ownership of ideas. It was a place of unrestricted thought and deep respect for intellectual exchange. And I suppose the debate on the diaspora needs the impetus of Uignish proportions. I can see attempts to fill this aching gap by many organisations that have a well-oiled machinery that focus on funding opportunities or have a large already existing infrastructure that can link to the Irish abroad. The title of this paper is thus, There's Gold in Damdar Hills, bringing attention to the fear that the unit for the Irish abroad might be reduced to a bank teller with a purely monetary role doling out money for anything Irish that coincides with visits of dignitaries or finds itself supporting nice ideas. Brian Harvey's welcome attention to this report may help us make the appropriate enlightened response to the Goodbody report. This report indicates that we need to focus on value for money. However, it must never be forgotten that we must never forget the emigrants that have found themselves in difficult circumstances. Finding people in need is an ongoing challenge. Identifying those that are most isolated and vulnerable in order to provide culturally sensitive support and care are proving a difficult challenge, yet it's a desire, I believe, of the Irish taxpayer that we use every effort to find these people and support them. When we look at a wonderful commitment to overseas aid from this country, the why of achieving a 0.7% of GDP by 2012 is an obvious why that gives an impetus to our nation's response to overseas aid. In this vein, what is the why of a relationship with our diaspora? This answer must come from real consultation with those networks that are part of the efforts to engage the diaspora. We must also be thinking outside the box to new horizons and new frontiers. This can't be executed, though, without some strategic process that has definite terms of reference. And we need opportunities to expand our ideas and not be limited to our individual need and area of service, but must wear the all-embracing hat of nationhood without frontiers. The opportunity given to us at the foot of the constitutional amendment in 1998 that stated that, furthermore, the Irish nation cherishes its special affinity with people of Irish ancestry living abroad who share its cultural identity and heritage, which redefined nationhood, but it hasn't really stimulated the debate it deserves. So just a note on AIN's contribution, and as I listened to those involved with AIN since its foundation, I always admired their commitment to a cause that had little support and attention. In earlier years, it was a lonely work, scraping together monies to bring attention to the plight of those leaving our shores. However, we never realised that the contribution of AIN was going to make to other services here in Ireland other than the Irish emigrant. AIN's support for the rights and benefits of emigrants have served as a sensitive foundation to now come to our country. Issues that have been ignored are now being faced by those who arrive here. For instance, the lack of clarity around the recognition of overseas qualification still torments many of those who wish to return and also who come to our shore. Other countries have developed mechanisms to support the recognition of qualifications. In short, if there is a will, it can happen. Other issues like the need to put in place a path to citizenship for people who devote a large part of their life to the economic well-being of a nation is essential for social cohesion. And we have found in our work with emigrants that where that didn't happen, the consequences for lives and the cost to society is quite enormous. And the importance of ethnic radio and television cannot be underestimated for communicating to people information about their rights and their needs. And the work of AIN in assisting centres abroad as they set up good local networking agencies has been an important focus of our work and allows increased communications between groups in Ireland and overseas. The support and establishment of reliable and dependable groups that represent their people abroad where they settle is another important factor that's noted that aids integration. As I said earlier, considering the head start we had on emigration, we should have more mature policies for emigrants. I feel it's only now, with the UNIT and with organisations such as AIN and other umbrella bodies, that we have the infrastructure in place to begin this dialogue in earnest. I note that we have much to learn from many of the nations of people who come to our land now. Many of their societies are more advanced on issues like political representation and have more advanced policies to assist people returning. Many other countries have a finely tuned system that records the inward and outward flow of people, which in turn contributes to sound, responsive and well articulated policy. So I end where I begun by stating that we are a learning organisation. Thus we know the challenges ahead. We only know that we don't know those challenges, but we know that we have the openness and courage to face them. I leave with a quote from the famous man, a man who never emigrated and never will. He lives in an ordinary town in Springfield, somewhere in the USA, and his name is Homer Simpson. In one episode, he outlines three sentences that will get you through life that he passes on to his devoted son, Bart. Number one, cover for me. Number two, oh, good idea, boss. Number three, it was like this when I got here. I thank Noreen and the board for not sitting back and for getting on with the task of allowing AIN to mature to the point where it is making a profound impact on Irish civil society and is giving a valuable ongoing service to Irish emigrants. And just finally, I remember once on holidays down in Kerry, it was in the 1980s, and I had to ring home in Dublin. And I went into Duke's golf course, and I lifted the phone, and I was put through to the exchange in Tralee. And I waited for a few minutes, and I was put through to the exchange then in Limerick, and I waited for a few minutes. And I was put through to the exchange then in Dublin, and I waited for a few minutes, and was finally connected to home. And that was only 15 years ago. Sorry, that was not. I forget my own age. It was 20 years ago, not 25 years ago maybe. And, you know, in terms of how the world has changed, as I say at the beginning, that it's not just about the emigrant, it's about all the services that relate to the emigrant are changing and how we can use them more forcibly to include people in this nation. And the example of that today is being able to broadcast this conference to emigrant centres across the world. Whether that be a large group in New York or whether it be two people sitting in the Antarctic at the moment, you know, that ability is there to involve more people in the life of this nation. And I think that using these forums and using this great ability to connect, we can really heartfully engage our diaspora in ways that will, make this nation a more vibrant place and include those people, as the Constitution now demands, include those people in the life of our society today. So thank you, and I hand you back to our chairperson.
Thank you very much indeed, Father Allen. That was a tremendous tour de force on the whole subject of emigration. It's topical, reflective, and leaves us with a lot of food for thought. We're keeping on time, and it's now my pleasure to introduce our next speaker, Brian Harvey. Brian is an independent social researcher, and he works for voluntary and community organisations in both parts of Ireland, in Britain and continental Europe, in the area of social policy, poverty, equality, community development and European integration. He will give us a critique of the recent Goodbody report. Brian Harvey.
Cheers, thank you.
Hi, good morning. Thank you very much for inviting me here this morning. I've been asked to give a presentation on the Goodbody's Value for Money report and to look forward to the context of that for the development of services for Irish emigrants in the future. First of all, the context, and I've been asked first to take a brief look at the historical context here. The historical context goes back to 1999 when the Bishop's Commission for Emigrants asked for a report on Irish emigrant services, and that outlined a whole set of things which it was felt should be done, both to increase funding but also improve the structures and environment in which Irish emigrant services worked. In the Programme for Prosperity and Fairness, which was the National Social Partnership Agreement in the year 2000, there was a formal endorsement of that idea, which led to the government establishing in 2002 the Task Force on Irish Emigration and Irish Emigrants. This proposed essentially three things. First, it proposed there be a substantial increase in funding for Irish emigration services, which up to that point had been somewhat low. Second, it proposed that there be an agency, an independent agency, for Irish people abroad, as a semi-state agency in effect, and third, that this agency should comprise civil society organisations, that's voluntary and community groups, non-governmental organisations, whatever your language is, and that they should have much more of an input and a contribution in the development of immigration policy. The government responded to that by establishing an interdepartmental working group which issued a short report, I think it was about 5 pages, the following year, which in effect said, let's proceed with the financial end first and bring on the other things soon thereafter. But in effect, it seemed to endorse what the task force was saying. And on foot of that, the government then did establish the Irish Abroad idea, but it was established as a unit within the Department of Foreign Affairs. It was not established as an independent agency, which had been the recommendation of the task force, and not something that was contradicted by the Interdepartmental Working Group either. I think it's important to say that funding has increased, and I presented the figures for you there, very, very substantially indeed, from 3.1 million euros for 73 groups in 2003 to 11.6 million for 184 groups last year. Funding this year is estimated to be at around 15 million euros. 90% of that approximately goes to Britain. That is the pattern that has existed for many years. 10% to the United States, 3% to immigration advice services within Ireland itself, and 2% for ROW, that's rest of the world. Okay. So let me talk a bit about the Goodbody's report. This was done in July 2007. It's now with the Department of Foreign Affairs for consideration. It follows what's called a standard template, a standard formula, which is devised by the Department of Finance, and is called the Value for Money, to use the jargon, the FM Value for Money template, which is published by the Department of Finance, and it's available for anyone who wants to look at it. The report, I think, is likely to be implemented, unless it is contested or argued about in the meantime, and that is my understanding of where the process is at the moment. Now, asking one consultant to make a commentary on another consultant's report puts me in an entirely invidious position and leaves me open to someone else doing the same back to me, what I will do to them. So for that reason, I'm going to tell you what I like about the Goodbody report. Okay. I do like it. There are some nice features about it. It's very readable, okay? Some consultancy reports aren't. This is, okay? I find it very readable. It follows logically. It is not dense. It's easy to follow the logic, the chapters, the argument. There are no sort of mathematical formulas in it and long tables that certainly would defeat me, and I assure you I can be quite easily defeated by them. It's a very useful source of information. There's a pack of information. If you want an informative guide to Irish Immigrant Services now and where they're at in an up-to-date state of that, I would advise you to read the report. It's very good from that point of view. There are case studies of 5 centres working in Britain, and those again I find very useful, and they give a very good up-to-date picture of the situation there today. So I said, unlike many consultancy reports, this is extremely readable, useful, informative, valuable, a very helpful contribution to the discussion. So I want to say those are important features about the report that I like, and which I would imagine you will like as well. A number of very interesting issues arise from it. First of all, it draws attention to the new emerging stream of funding within Immigrant Services of funding for culture, sports and heritage. This is a new element, and again the tables show very clearly where and how that emerged, and that is accounting for 12.5% of UK funding this year. Okay, the numbers are around 8-9% overall, but that's the current figure for the UK this year, and that's something that wasn't there about, say, 10 years ago, wasn't there even 5 years ago, and it's an important feature of how the funding picture has changed, and maybe it's something that can be afforded with the increase in funding overall. But Goodbody's report does warn, quite rightly in my view, of the danger of, and I'm going to use an economic term, displacement. In other words, the government funding is going into something that could be paid for by something else if it weren't. In other words, Goodbody does say, look, if this money is not grant aided, is it possible that Irish immigrants would pay for sports, culture and heritage services themselves, or could they get them from the host nations as well? In other words, is there a danger that public money is going to replace private money here, which most people think is probably not a good idea, and most economists would think would be a shocking idea. It accepts the difficult situation of Irish immigrants. Now, those of us who know the area know that academics in particular, but all researchers who study the situation of immigrants, have said, look, not all immigrants have had a totally successful experience abroad. A lot of Irish immigrants have not been, quote, economically or socially successful. Many Irish immigrants live in poverty, and that has been documented very extensively in Britain. And Goodbody does accept, and indeed it does not in any way contest, what we've come to know for many, many years, and that is again very welcome. The importance of Irish services abroad being dedicated to the social inclusion of Irish immigrants abroad is fully accepted without any qualification, and that too is very welcome. It does reject the idea of an agency for the Irish abroad, which was recommended by the task force, was seemingly endorsed by the interdepartmental group, and it says that having an agency would be more costly than having a unit within the department, and second, other countries don't have agencies for Irish people abroad, and that is a very definite conclusion. It comes to within quite a short period of text. It also looks at policy impacts of Irish Immigrant Services abroad, pages 41 and 42 on the downloadable copy, which is required by the Value for Money services. I'm not sure if it tells us a lot about those impacts, so it does describe what they're attempting to do. If we look at the actual recommendations of the Goodbody report, it says on page 44 that the programme design is effective, that no change is needed. Okay, it says that very clearly. But it then says the heritage, sport and culture programme should be expanded, but it doesn't say how much. It then says on page 64 that there is an urgent need for a more formal application process, with grants being conditional on performance, with monitoring systems put in place, with evaluation systems put in place, with performance indicators, with visits to inspect projects, progress reports, and possibly service agreements later. But this more rigorous regime should not apply to small grants, which it defines as being in the range of 5 to 10,000 euros. Furthermore, it says that there should be indicative allocations in Britain. First of all, by geographical area, that you should actually have particular amounts earmarked for London, and then it suggests two other locations, Manchester and Birmingham, and implies the rest. In other words, 60%, 80%, but it doesn't give a figure, should go to the London services, an unspecified percentage to the Manchester figures, an unspecified percentage to the Birmingham figure, and so on. And the allocation should also be by theme, okay? That fixed proportions or set proportions or indeed indicative proportions should go to welfare projects, which it describes as being for older people, counselling, training and advice, community network projects, sports, second line organisations like the Federation of Irish Societies, like the Birmingham Forum, for information projects for heritage and culture. Elsewhere it says, the system works well. There is no need for change, but maybe there should be a more formal system later. And it says that existing allocations outside Britain, we're talking here about the States and the other countries, are sound, the recommendations are sound, they're based on the personal knowledge of embassy personnel. It says there is considerable expertise amongst those officials who take these decisions. They are expert in monitoring and in evaluation, although it says this is done on an ad hoc basis, and they have exactly the information that they need in order to be able to reach these judgments. Okay, that is what the Goodbody report actually says. Now, I think there are a number of problems with this, and I'd like to explore these with you this morning. First of all, I'm struck by the fact that on page 44 it says there's no need for change, and at page 64 it says there's an urgent need for change. I cannot reconcile those two assertions. Okay, if you can, that's great, please tell me about it. But I find that really problematical. There's no need for change, page 44, there's an urgent need for change on page 64. Okay. Second, how do we know that the unsupervised system in the United States has worked well? Because they say so. Is it good enough in this current day and age for grants to be made on the basis of personal knowledge and personal information by individuals? I question that. I don't have that competence. I don't know if you think you have that competence. Does anyone here have that competence? Personal allocations based on personal sound knowledge. How do we know? The only way you know if these judgments are sound is if you have some kind of peer review. And there isn't. Okay? So I think that's a second serious problem. Saying that these judgments are good doesn't actually make them so. Furthermore, I find it very difficult to understand why should the system in Britain be put under some kind of formal regime, but not in the United States, Australia, Zimbabwe and the rest of the world. Here Goodbody seems to make an equation between size and the need for rigour. If you have a large programme, it should be formally evaluated. If you have a small one, it doesn't. Well, I'm sorry, but I disagree with that. Okay, if you have a small programme, it is just as worthy of rigorous standard as a big grants programme. Okay, and this equation of size with the need to evaluate is entirely unproven and a very suspicious basis on which to evaluate and judge the quality of services to voluntary and community organisations. I can't think of any other aspect of Irish public life that would put up with such an approach. The proposed performance indicators that are put forward, and they are put forward, focus on quantity of services. In other words, they're looking at how many people come in, how many people do you clock in for presentation and social welfare advice services. They don't look at the quality. Okay? You can clock in infinitely increasing numbers all the time, but if the quality of service is going down and you're not measuring that, what is the benefit of doing that? So there must be quality in that examination. I think there's a real danger also in the recommendation around increasing culture, sports and heritage. Okay, could I say that I'm nothing against culture, sports and heritage, quite the opposite. But what I do worry is, if you increase that budget considerably, will that risk the amount of money that's going to social inclusion? Will that risk the amount of money that's going to second line organisations? Because something's got to give. Okay. And I think that's a real question. And I think the issue of the relationship between civil society, by which I mean the NGOs, the voluntary and community groups in Britain, the United States and elsewhere, is completely missed in the report. What is to be the relationship between these groups and the department? Because that's where policy is decided, okay? And you cannot separate policy from services. Services are inseparable from policy. You can't influence one without the other. If you can't get access to the policy-making, decision-making centre, you're not going to be able to influence the services that follow on foot of it. And I don't know, because the report doesn't say this, is where was the consultation with civil society in this report? Okay, and the value for money template of the Department of Finance does require such consultation. It's very clearly stated. Now, it is true that the consultants did meet the five centres in Britain, and they met other stakeholders and experts, but it doesn't tell us who they are. So this report is not transparent. We don't actually know. And finally, in this set of problem areas, the case for dismissing the agency for the Irish abroad was not made. Now, the case that was put forward by the task force was very carefully argued. It was very specific. It was elaborated in many details. So to dismiss it in a paragraph, I think, is not actually being fair. Okay. Furthermore, to say that, well, other countries don't have agencies for their people abroad is also not a credible argument, because very few other countries have so many immigrants abroad and they don't need them. Okay. So that argument, I think, is suspect as well. So I find this a very, very unsatisfactory aspect of this report. But if we look at what does the report actually mean, okay, what would happen if the report is implemented as it stands? Okay. It will mean, assuming that the judgment of page 64 is followed rather than the judgment of page 44, that there will be more monitoring. There will be more paperwork, there will be more evaluation, there will be performance indicators, and I raise the question about quantity or quality, there will be more inspection visits, there will be conditions, and if you don't meet your first round of performance indicators, you may not get the second round of the grant. There may be SLA service level agreements, okay? Those are the things that may happen in Britain, okay? There will probably be indicative allocations by location and by type of service. Again, I question how practical is that, okay? Say, for example, you decide that 60% of the money shall go to London-based services, okay? But the total number or the total level of application from London actually falls that year, or the applications aren't very good. Say the allocation that year is 10% for Birmingham. Say Birmingham comes up with a big pile of really good projects, okay, but you're there over the 10%. Are you going to find yourself turning down good quality projects in favour of bad quality projects elsewhere to keep up the allocation percentages? Okay, that's the kind of difficulty you can get into. Okay, and I'm not saying there's anything in principle wrong with that, but I do think the practical implications of setting these kind of percentages like that have to be thought through. You can make them more flexible, but then if you do that, what's the point in having them, and so on. So that one has to be a lot more carefully thought through. Okay. No change elsewhere, but yet. And here we're in this funny contradiction of the report of there's no need for change, but there's an urgent need for change. There's no need to formalise things in the United States, but maybe there is later, okay? Which I think is unsatisfactory. But there's to be no agency for the Irish abroad. There's a very definite view by Goodbody's report that this idea should be buried, okay? And again, I wonder, is that the best way to proceed, okay? There are many situations in which agencies can do work very well. I think particularly, for example, of the Combat Poverty Agency, which has ensured that social inclusion has been a dominant discourse in Irish life and is now, which it wasn't 20 years ago. And that was done initially with a very small staff. I think they had four staff, which is actually less than the total number of officials allocated to the Irish Abroad Unit. So small agencies can do a lot. And we do have a history in this country of, I think, undervaluing the value of agencies at times. Okay. It also says that there will be no change in the structural arrangements in the Department of Foreign Affairs relationship. And I think that's a pity, because in the Department of Foreign Affairs there are good structural arrangements for consultation over Irish aid and for human rights. And I can't understand why those can't also be put in place. But the formal structured relationship between the NGO sector and the civil servants in there around Irish immigration services as well. And I think it's a pity that the Goodbody's report didn't explore that. So to the extent that the task that the agency should be buried. This report actually represents a step back from where we were in 2003, and indeed if you include the Bishop's Commission report in 1999. But, and this is a good thing, there is an invitation in the Good Buddies report for the voluntary and community groups to contribute to the devising of the performance indicators. It says very clearly, we think there should be performance indicators, and we think voluntary and community groups should come forward and suggest what they should be. Okay? So that is an invitation for dialogue, and that is a very good feature of the report. It does, and it puts the onus on voluntary and community groups like those that are here today to go back to the department and say, look, thank you for this invitation for performance indicators. This is what we think they should be. This is how we think they should operate, or indeed not operate. This is how we think they should be, quality as well as quantity and so on. So there's an invitation and an opportunity and a window for dialogue there. But before looking at the challenges, which will be my concluding set of comments on this, I actually think we should look at somewhat different criteria for how do we look at the formalisation of funding programmes. And I'm not and do not want to be negative about the ideas of monitoring, about evaluation, about performance indicators and so on. I am conscious that when these things are brought in, they're often brought in such a way that they are a bureaucratic and a paperwork burden to service managers and so on. But these are important disciplines. They're important disciplines when you're spending money, and it's important that we think rigorously when public money is being spent and when we're running programmes. And what I'm going to make a suggestion here is we look at the European experience of what makes for good programme design, okay? And this, I think, saves us a lot of reinventing the wheel, because if we look at some of the work that's been done recently in Europe, and I'm referring particularly to the Open Society Institute, we know what makes for good programmes. And these are the kind of areas I would very much personally prefer that the Good Buddies report had talked about. Because we know that what works well in programme design, in Europe anyway, is projects and programmes that focus on impact. That we actually know what is the impact of those things. How do they really change the situation of the groups they're working for? Do they lift, for example, Irish people in Britain out of poverty? Do they ensure that Irish people are better treated by the British political and administrative system? Whether that's the census, the Home Office, whatever else it is. Are they treated better by the local authorities? And can we measure that? Do the host societies take on a growing proportion of their share of the burden of looking after Irish immigrants? Because I don't hear much of an argument in this country that Irish social welfare services should not be looking after our many new immigrants who have been coming in. So I think we should apply the same test elsewhere. Programme design works well when they fund projects that have fresh thinking, which address the root causes of particularly poverty and social exclusion and discrimination, that deal with hard issues, like particularly discrimination, like the situation of older Irish people in Britain, that actually confront the very, very difficult issues. Programmes that are concentrated, that actually concentrate on particular themes, particular issues, particular difficulties, particular problematics, that have a critical mass that enable them to actually do good work. It's a bit like I compare it to services in Ireland for older people, where some older people's groups can get any amount of grants for a minibus. Minibus grants are all over the place. They don't cost a lot of money. But when you're actually trying to get a service that is going to do something very serious about older people's poverty, you find it much more difficult to get that kind of critical mass necessary to make a real impact on those issues. Projects that last for sufficiently long duration to make an impact. Those that are on a sufficient scale, so that you don't have a multiplicity of tiny baby projects that aren't actually making much of an impact, but bigger projects that work better. That's not to say there shouldn't be smaller ones as well. Of course there should be. Programs and projects that drive policy issues into the political system, into the administrative system, into local government in Britain, and so on. Those are what makes projects and programs more interesting and more effective. Programs and projects that extract and disseminate learning. Okay, again, I would criticise the Good Buddies report here because it says the officials who run this program already have all the information they need to do monitoring and evaluation, which is done on an ad hoc basis, a few lines later, on an ad hoc basis. Hello, but the whole basis of monitoring and evaluation is that it's not ad hoc. So what we do need is systems in place that extract the lessons from existing Irish funding programmes, and I don't see that being done, that disseminate good practice, good information, good learning that comes out of Irish programmes that operate in Britain and elsewhere. that also spread good practice. So you need to build in systems that identify good practice, that incentivize good practice, that reward good practice by maybe larger grants the following year or something else, and that then disseminates that. And I don't see any of those things going on. I don't see evidence that the reports that are coming back from Irish organizations are being read, are being analyzed and synthesized into this kind of much more rigorous discipline that will actually tell us something useful about what's going on. And from my own visits to Irish services in Britain in the late 1990s, a lot of good stuff was going on, but it wasn't being captured at this level. So a lot of good lessons were being missed. And projects that leave a legacy, that actually leave something useful behind, that achieve something permanent. Again, are we looking at those kind of criteria for projects? And then finally, some kind of system of critical feedback from civil society. Can we establish ways in which NGOs, voluntary and community groups, can have a channel for feedback into the department and the other stakeholders to say, look, these are better ways to run these funding programs, these are other ways and different ways. In other words, what I'm really saying is value for money should, instead of thinking of more formalized system, should actually think of tougher tests for programs. So I think the bar should actually be raised an awful lot higher, and I think you'd get much better and much more effective programs as a result by virtue of looking at the experience elsewhere. So just finally, I think the challenges for us, and by us I mean those of us concerned about, interested in Irish immigrant services, must be to ensure that performance indicators and the other systems of evaluation focus on quality as well as quantity, that they focus on policy and the policy issues arising as well as the services, that they focus on impact as well as inputs and outputs from services. And that work has not yet well been done. That they should make this formalisation, which is the word that Goodbodies uses, a positive experience, not an additional burden. Okay? And I think the invitation to dialogue over performance indicators is the invitation to take part in that debate. And I think that opportunity should be seized. And I think it would be a terrible pity if it weren't seized, because it's an invitation for dialogue. I would have thought there should be a universal grant-giving system, by which I mean there should be a common system operated for Irish immigrants in all countries abroad, not a separate system for Britain and different systems for the rest of the world with different and indeed unknown criteria in other countries. And I think there should be external moderation. There is, with the Dion Committee, a number of people are invited from experts in the Irish immigration field onto that committee, and that supplies a form of moderation, a form of external comment on the grant giving process. But if it's good in Britain, it should be good elsewhere. So there should be external moderation of all the grant giving programs, and they should not be made on the basis of personal judgment of officials, however good they are. Okay, I think it's important that there should be no displacement. Okay, in other words, that the heritage, culture and sports grants do not take the place of money that is needed for second line organisations and for social inclusion work. I think in the area of civil society, I think there is very important that there be proper channels established for dialogue. And I use the term regular, structured and sustained dialogue because I'm taking from the new constitution, the new European constitution or reform treaty that is coming in, because Article 47 does refer to the importance of regular sustained dialogue between governments and their civil society. And I think that debate has to happen between the NGOs and the Department of Foreign Affairs, not on an informal basis, where it should happen anyway, but on a more formal basis, where all these issues can be raised, brought together, where we can do the analysis and the programmes that we're talking about. And then finally, I think the much tougher, more rigorous, more demanding kind of standards around programme design at European level, I think we could benefit an awful lot from them. And those would be what I would see as the key ways forward. So thank you very much for your attention.
Ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to thank Brian Harvey for his very thoughtful and incisive critique of the Goodbody report. As you heard, he raised many questions, and I've no doubt we will be able to pursue those, because we now have up to 1 o'clock for questions and discussion. So perhaps if we... anybody has got any question for Brian or for Father Alan before we go on to discussion? Perhaps we might do it that way. So we take any question that you may have. Michael.
Yeah, thanks, Brian. Very informative. I'd like to know, when you're talking about funding, as you said, you have to raise the bar. I wrote down a few of your quotable quotes. How do you reconcile the fact that the number of, when I was doing my research, say, 10 years ago in Britain, the number has gone down by at least 50% since then. The number of Irish born, and the same in America, it's way down to a few thousand. It depends what you mean by Irish, of course. But how do you reconcile the fact that the money is zooming up, really getting big, and at the same time the numbers are dropping, and there are dire needs here for taxpayers' money as well in the migration area? So just a general question around that.
I'm going to have to do what they do on Mastermind, which is pass on that one, because I'm not familiar with your more recent work on the figures. I'm sorry, I'm just not sufficiently up to date on that.
Well, the census data say 91 would show that the number of Irish in Britain has halved, Irish born now, and the number of Irish in the States is dropping very rapidly in recent years. So it's just both of those would be reasonably accurate, I think people would agree with that. Yeah. So in the meantime, the amount of money is gone up. There's an inverse correlation there.
I mean, the only useful comment I could make is to say that certainly from the studies I did, which are a few years old at this stage, I accept that the level of social need was quite high and quite acute. So whatever was not there in the numbers was certainly there in the urgency and in the intensity of need that certainly was there and which social services should be meeting there.
Thank you.
So that's as much as I can do. I'm sorry, I can't be more helpful on
Thank
that
you,
one.
Brian. Father,
I'd just like to comment that one of the more enlightening things that Brian said there, the emphasis is on, and I find this particularly with immigrants, migrant communities generally, is the quality of the service is something that is deeply different to the quality of service that one who is in their own homeland might need. I saw this when I worked in Sydney, particularly with elderly Italians, that when they were in their last hours of their life, last few months, they reverted back to what they knew, which was Italian. So the ordinary social services could not meet that need. Even in terms of somebody I know from years ago who came from the Gaeltacht, as a young child, went to hospital, and the parents went there, they spoke only Irish and nurses couldn't understand them. So when you look at the quality of service for immigrant groups, you're looking at a substantially different issue. And from travelling with people who look after immigrant groups, even the Irish in Britain, London's a much bigger city. You know, travelling across London to visit isolated elderly takes an awful lot of work and huge train journeys just to spend an hour with a person. So I think there's a great openness, and I think everyone would agree with that, even those who fund what Brian is saying, is looking at the quality of service to a migrant, because I think it's substantially different to the quality of service one would receive as a person who lives in their own homeland. And the demands culture around that are much more different and need to be evaluated differently. That's the only comment I'd make. And the only thing that saddens me is that the numbers have dropped and there weren't the type of resources being put in place then for those people that are now departed from us. That it's, you know, but I think in essence we can learn a lot as, say, a learning organisation in the engagement of migrants. We can learn a lot about the quality of service that people coming to this country will need into the future. That it's not about quantity, it's about that issue of quality that Brian highlighted.
Thank you, Father Rannan. Next question, yes.
Couple of points. Referring to what Alan said about the human, you know, the cost in terms, you know, in human terms of providing a service is very, very important. And if you've got big organisations, and the comment that Alan's just said about London, you know, one part of London's here, someone is living here, you can't easily kind of get that service to that person easily. So sometimes big is not effective, is not providing any kind of quality. And you know, if you're chasing numbers all the time rather than quality of service and the impact that you're having to one or ten people, you know, it's dead easy to mark the numbers without really knowing what impact funding is having on, you know, a person there. So big isn't always best. Small, particularly when you're getting old, can be fantastic and can be meaningful for you. Big is very inaccessible. You're just part of a system. And
one other comment. The role of the second tier organisations, I think it would be useful to have it that very clearly defined.
Thank you very much indeed. Yes,
I just wanted to comment as well on the issue. I very welcome the looking at the impact, because I think in the U.S. the situation is very clear. Number one, the census does not reflect the number of undocumented people in the U.S. And while I think we can all agree that the numbers have gone down, there is no way of knowing how many undocumented by their very nature are in the states. They are undocumented. And that one of the very important things in the U.S. to remember is that for these undocumented people, and even for people who are documented and who are, you know, legally living there, there almost is no safety net in the U.S., which differs very much from what people are used to here and what they even get in Great Britain. The Irish centres, which are, you know, very thinly spread on the ground, are the safety net. If you have a health problem, if you have, you know, a substance abuse issue, there is almost no place else that people can go. And if you're undocumented, this is added to by the fact that you're afraid to go even where the services are available. So, again, it's the impact that you're having rather than, you know, the quantity and the fact that people have no other option in the States.
Thank you, Sheila.
Yes, Olson Cowley. I should have said earlier on, for people who don't know me or know my name, I'm the author of a book called The Men Who Built Britain, which is subtitled The History of the Irish Navvy, but what it is in essence is the history of Irish male migrant labour in Britain specifically, rather than in the United States or elsewhere. And my concern since that book was published in 2001 has been increasingly with my appreciation of the predicament of older Irish people in Britain, predominantly from a rural background. It's well understood that the major cohorts in the early to mid-20th century were from a rural background. Their concerns are different, their orientations are different, their cultural orientations are different. And so this is where this notion that increasing allocations for culture and heritage run a risk of being subsumed by fashionable agencies for the deliverance of culture in quotation marks, a la Riverdance or whatever it might be, whereas I have an increasing sense that people, irrespective of circumstances, older Irish emigrants, male and female, not necessarily marginalised, maybe quite comfortably off, but no way are they going to be able to return to this country for a variety of reasons, maybe even wouldn't want to. Their sense of isolation is exacerbated by their feeling that they are culturally alienated, not just from the host society, but from modern Ireland. And their orientation is towards a notion of Irish values, Irish mores, Irish culture, that is associated with their youth and the Ireland of their youth. And there is an opportunity, and it has to do with this notion of quality rather than quantity. It's difficult to deliver such a concept in practice, but I think radio, I think Pascal Mooney's programme, for example, is a good vehicle for it. Bringing that sense of home to people into their homes, into their apartments, into their bedsits via the radio, via visits, via even a thing like that's a double DVD that I did down in South Wexford, Reminiscences of Old Days, Old Ways. It's people of that age group who never left Ireland talking about what it was like for them as children to work, to live, to go to school, to go to church, to socialise. Somebody watching that on their DVD, watching it in the Irish Centre, watching it on television, is brought back and feels a sense of inclusion. But if that were to emanate from a community in Ireland, that's what I mean by the difficulty of delivering this kind of service. I don't know whether an agency per se can do that, or whether an individual can do it in a given community through an agency and deliver it through another agency in Britain to those individuals, you know, so that they feel they're being reached out to. They feel that they belong, and that they'll take that sense of belonging with them in their last months, days and hours, as Alan referred to earlier.
Thank you. I think, you know, what we have to hold before us is what is the goal for any person who goes to another country, and the goal is integration. That's the goal, that they set up and they live well in that new place. When you look at the elderly Irish who went to Britain, they hadn't a hope of integration.
It wasn't possible for a lot of them in their circumstances. As one taxi man said to me when I was telling the worker, he says, you know, only I met the right woman, I'd be there myself. You know, the marriage, a relationship was the one that got them out of the pub and back into a life where integration was possible. And as a few weeks ago, I met a man in South London with one of our visitation people, and I said to him, one of the questions I asked is, how much did you hold back for yourself? He says, enough to go to the pictures. How could a man who was sending all his money home, because the only way out of that trap from the family was to get married and be respected, he never got married, so he's always in that bind of sending money home. How could a man become integrated when he hadn't the resources in his pocket to get established? So if you don't have the right social structures or policies in place, you'll never allow a person to be integrated. That is the gift to them. That's what you want them to achieve. And even, I was reading this book on Japan and global migration. The last chapter talks about the importance of NGOs in that. Now, there's 250 NGOs in Japan working with migrant groups, precisely to meet those barriers that inhibit integration and help move the human being towards a feeling of being at home in a strange land. And that's just, it's a journey of the heart, it's a journey of policy, it's a journey of support, of structure, and the whole. And that, I think sometimes in the Irish thing, we forget that's what it's about. It's about giving the person the hope of integration. If there's any barriers there, help them remove them. How can the undocumented be integrated? How can they? So don't talk about it. You know, so that is the, when you talk about what is the bar, what is the product of you want, the outcome, is that a person feels within their own resources they can become an integrated part of the society in which they're now living.
Because this is one of the difficulties with that, a self-imposed barrier, a rejection of the host society, specifically Britain and all things British. And it has struck me very forcibly, living amongst the Irish in Britain for the period of time I spent 2 years in Manchester researching that book, immersed myself in it. And I am a dub. When I left here at 15 and went to join the RAF, but I lived in London for many years, did my third level studies in Britain as a mature student. I had no need, I didn't feel the need to be part of a wider Irish community. I didn't feel that need to get away, if you want to use that word, though it's pejorative. But the sense that you were going from the known to the known if you came from rural Ireland, because you were going to your own over there, who would find you a place to stay, find you the start, etc., etc. But as presence there solidified and children were raised, there was still a rejection of Britain and British values and British culture, and that was transmitted to the children, to the point where I've seen even a group of Irish descent third level graduates go out for a night out in the town. One was seen to be to have met a young man, very handsome young man, meet a very nice girl. His friend said to him, "Oh, she's a lovely girl, you going to see her again?" "Ah, no, she's not Irish."
I'll finish on this, that I think the greatest learning in the Irish emigrant experience, and I'm glad to see it's now been written about, and Queen's University are beginning to touch upon it, and they're doing some study on it, and Bobby Gilmore, who you know is famous in our work, he says essentially it's a journey of the heart. If the heart was damaged by rejection in the home place, the person can't find it within themselves to become integrated, because that's holding them back. And I think the one science that has not been studied in the migrant is that the emotional side of the journey. And I think that's where in the future the academic world will have to open its doors to that. And again, it's this whole debate we have between the emigrant as a unit of labour and a human being who's in need of hope. So I'm going to leave it at that, because there's other people wanting to
thank you, Ultram. Thank you, Father Alan. I have three people who have indicated they want to speak. Could I ask you, to, so that we can make the best use of the 15 minutes left, to indicate at the beginning whether it's a question or a comment that you're making. Now, the gentleman at the back row.
Sorry, it's been a bit of both, but I'll make it short. Would it be fair to say that Irish civil servants are at a particular disadvantage in dealing with emigration because of the structure of the career structure within the civil service? Every civil servant has particular and first-hand experience of healthcare, education, etc., because they've been through that system themselves. It's unlikely that the majority of civil servants have any long-term personal experience of emigration. The career structure tends to be that you go in early, you go in out of college or whatever, and then you stay. It's the only way to build a career. So it would seem to me that if that's true, that that's a particularly strong argument for developing an agency rather than an in-house approach. Any comment on that?
And just one other one then, it does also seem, Brian, from what you were saying, that we really have a split in terms of how we monitor what goes on. We can do lots of paperwork, and the paperwork tends to be, you work out what the funder wants you to tell them, you tell them that, you hope they're distant enough, and if they are, you get away with murder. And then you go off and do what you have to do anyway. That's the norm in business and in the community sector. The only thing that changes that is when they send in the accountants or the lawyers, those miserable people who actually want facts and figures, or when you're reporting to somebody close to you who actually knows that you're talking bullshit. The other way of doing it in Ireland is the personal contact thing, and you talked about that. And that just seems to lead to an awful lot of lazy sloppiness. An example being, at the conference looking on new relationships with the Irish diaspora, the big news out of that seemed to be that the government was going to channel more funds through the GA. Now, call me cynical, but a Fianna Fáil-dominated government giving money to the GA, I'm not sure that that was really for the benefit of immigrants. So I wonder any comment on that general issue too. Thanks.
Thank you, David. Brian, wait to the end, okay? Okay,
this lady. My name is Sally Mulready, and I work with the Irish Elderly Advice Network in London. Our project is based at the London Irish Centre, and I've been working in that area for 14 years. And my job is basically in two parts. One is frontline advice every day to older Irish people from all parts of Ireland, who've lived in Britain for many years. And, I recognise many of the descriptions here, but I think I also recognise that we've moved on. We've moved on. I want to maybe touch on that in a minute. The other thing is, I'm also an elected councillor in the East End of London. I just wanted to address just a couple of the issues in relation to the report. One of the things I wasn't sure about, because I think I missed it at the beginning, was who commissioned the report, which I was quite, I didn't get that. What I wanted to say in terms of an awful lot of the recommendations made in that report, I mean, some of them, I can understand why, you're saying, and I absolutely agree with you, the formalisation need not necessarily mean that we don't get it, that we're frightened by it, that we feel a burden by it. I do feel that Dion funding has been excellent for us. It has been really good. It's given us the security that we need, small projects, large projects. It's for informality up to now. Has almost made Dion a soft grant to get in comparison to other grants, and we've relaxed our guard in relation to it. We've relaxed it in relation to performance indicators and all of that. So I can absolutely see why we need to get that a little bit better than we have it. There are the nature of the beast as well. I mean, the priority has been for Dion funding for older people, for all the reasons that have been said in this room this morning. And I hear what you're saying about displacement. But I also run a pensioners choir, an Irish pensioners choir. And I've run that for the last 2 years. And we're now moving into drama, and we're rediscovering all the great writers and everything else in drama. And we're linking in with older people who love set dancing. So we're doing this all kind of intermixing thing. So I actually welcome the cultural funding. And I welcome that, because I think our perception of older people shouldn't necessarily be always in terms of need, isolation and all that. They are also interested in participating in society. And yes, integration didn't take place with that generation. But thanks to the Dion grant and thanks to the services that we're able to give and that whole area of improvement over the last 10 years, integration, late in the day, but it is starting to happen. And a recognition of new migrant communities, like the Polish community in particular, among older Irish people, is sort of saying, oh, you know, don't do what we did, talking about the building sites, don't be exploited like we were, you know, join a union, get involved in political participation, which is another area we've done. We ran a Polish-Irish pensioners evening, where we talked about not doing the things that we did wrong, but doing the things that we did right, and all of that kind of stuff. So, I have loads to say, but I'll say it in the lunchtime to people. I just want to finish on this in terms of the changing nature of the funding. We are funding in Dion funds in relation to where the large conglomerates of Irish people are. But in terms of the work I do, we have an awful lot of elderly Irish people who are in pockets of Britain that there isn't an Irish centre, that there isn't any kind of nucleus, and it's still the church is the contact. And I feel that we need to look at some kind of regional outreach working facility for older Irish people that will somehow maybe have an army of outreach workers, because I'm doing it by phone. I'm actually doing telephone, and I'm sure Peter has the same at London Irish Centre. And it's an area that I'm concerned about. The other changing thing, and this is my final point, the other changing thing is the changing nature of older Irish people. They are living longer and are becoming more and more dependent in terms of having to end up in residential care. And that isolation that Auntie Alton was talking about hits right back at them when they're plonked in residential care, having come from little pockets of Irish conurbations, too old to stay in them, and then they're plonked in care indifferently in residential care homes, and their isolation starts all over again. So we need to be looking at that as well. And I suppose my message is that welcome to Goodie Report, welcome what's happening in Queen's University. But I'm worried that we're not picking up these things, we're not picking up these changes. And these are the areas that we need, in my view, to start serving in the next 10 years.
Thank you, Sally. A lady over here. Now, time is pressing greatly.
Just a comment that I felt that some of our Irish who did come home, who found it so difficult to integrate with their own Irish. They were strangers in their own land. And I think that was the big thing that came across, that the gap was so great, they weren't smart enough for the present young generation Irish.
Thank you very much indeed. I'll take one further comment or question from the floor, if there is one. Jim Carroll.
Just to pick up on the points made by Alton and David here, and also Alan and Sally, I think we'd all agree that Ireland and our diaspora are moving ahead positively and have moved ahead positively. We're in the post-Good Friday Agreement era. So therefore, when we look at North America and we have Irish America, I'm an Irish American, we're moving in the direction of somebody in England saying, I'm Irish English, I'm Irish British. So there's no reason for isolation going forward. As Alan said, integration is the goal. And it's an integration with your identity intact. We retain a proud identity, but we integrate. Now, we've achieved that largely in America, because America is a market-based economy. And in Ireland, your social mobility is based on your market-based employment. And that is the reality. The supports that the government is providing are primarily geared on the people that are vulnerable and marginalised. But many people that are at the delivery point have experience. I mean, I think David's point is misleading. I personally have 3 years' experience in Britain and 5 years in North America. We're not coming in with blindfolded, myopic ideas. We're responding to need. And we obviously do this in community with the entire support community. And in that sense, the Goodbody Report is helpful. It's a synopsis of where we've been, where we're at, and where we're going. Not perfect, but no consultant's report is. Thank you.
Thank you, Jim. I'm sorry I can't take any further contributions from the floor, perhaps over lunch, and we have to be on time for lunch. Perhaps we can discuss that. Get the two members of the panel to reply. First of all, Brad.
Just a couple of points I'll respond to briefly. Who commissioned the report? The Department of Foreign Affairs commissioned the report and says so. Why they particularly commissioned this report at this stage, I don't know the answer to that. I do know that the Department of Finance does encourage all funding programs all over the country in all kinds of areas to be reviewed from time to time for value for money, and I think most of us would sign up to that as being a good idea. On your comments about civil servants, do they feel disadvantaged by not having had the immigration experience? Personally, I would have thought not. Personally, what I hear
about civil servants, and particularly about the Department of Foreign Affairs civil servants, is if they're given good advice by civil society, they will learn very quickly, they will find out very quickly the views of those that they should be listening to, and they will act on that. So the competence of those officials has, particularly in foreign affairs, not been under question at all. The point I'm trying to make is that the voice of civil society, there's not a channel whereby that is got across in a systematic way, and I would have a lot of confidence that if it were to be got across in a systematic way, that things would improve enormously. I think that is the deficit that has to be dealt with there. I think your question on the quality of monitoring is terribly important. And you've referred to, you know, people getting away with murder about, you know, with bad reporting. And I think that brings us to the issue of what kind of relationship are we going to get within the monitoring system. I think people don't mind filing reports if they think they're going to be read. But with good programme monitoring, they are read. They are picked up. They are synthesised. They are analysed. They are acted on. Let me tell you what some of my friends in the development aid area tell me. They tell me that their reports into the Department of Foreign Affairs are read. They tell me if they screw up on a project, they tell the Department of Foreign Affairs, look, we got it wrong, it went wrong. And the Department of Foreign Affairs says, right, but you are probably trying to do something right. In other words, there's an acceptance of the right to make mistakes. There's an acceptance that things go wrong. And, you know, the only way to avoid that is never to do anything. So if you have a culture within the monitoring system of allowing, giving permission to people to do things wrong, of questioning reports that are bad, of knowing that good reports are going to be part of a process of synthesis, of good practice learning, of the dissemination of good outcomes and so on, then I think you have a very healthy environment. And that's the kind of thing we should have, I think, in emigrant aid services. In terms of GAA and grants, this whole area of public investment in culture, I mean, I think it was Minister Michael D. Higgins made so much of a difference to our seeing the value of that there should be public investment in culture. Okay, and I think we all accept that. And I think you've given some very good examples of how that works to very good effect. I think the issue particularly arises around the test of displacement. And I think the issue you particularly raised about GAA, if you apply the displacement test, should Irish emigrant money be going towards GAA in Britain? I think you've got to ask the question of, if that money doesn't go there, could those people afford it themselves? Or, granted that the GAA in particular gets a whole set of other grants from arts, sports, tourism, the lottery and everything else, you know, are there other routes for that in particular to be funded? So I think the questions you've raised are, you know, entirely important and useful there. Just on two other things that are left, you mentioned the issue of Irish people in pockets all over the place for whom there is not a group working with them. To me, that's the kind of thing that an Irish agency might be a lot better at picking up on. To me, that's the kind of thing where fresh thinking is needed, and that's why I particularly put up a slide which says, do you have a programme design that is encouraging fresh thinking? Is there scope? Instead of having these indicative things of 6%, like London, 40%, Manchester, whatever else it is, should there be a proportion for fresh thinking, new projects, new ideas, either on a big scale or, as you made a very eloquent case for, on a small scale, then that to me is an interesting way of building something and factoring something into programme design. And just the final point which you also made, which was the issue of informality of the Dion and it being a bit soft, that can be both a good thing and a bad thing. I think I would make the case for something different. I'm not making the case for more paperwork. I'm not making the case for going through the motions of evaluation, reporting, monitoring, and that kind of thing. What I'm making the case for, I'd like to think, is a much tougher programme environment. Not tougher in the paperwork, but tougher in the questions we're asking. Tougher in the impacts we're making. Tougher about the issue of, if the numbers of Irish people are declining, what is the demand for services? Will we reach a stage one day where there actually is much less need for these services and we can think of doing less? I know that's a heretical thing to say, but if we're asking the right questions, we'll be looking at those kind of issues. So I'm talking about a much tougher environment around what we do, how we do it, how we question ourselves, how we circulate that information around ourselves and share with the departmental officials and so on. So when I'm talking about raising the bar, I'm talking about a more rigorous approach and more ideas-centred approach to the entire thing. And you can still have a lot of informality with that rigour as well. So I don't see these as in any... They should not be
If you run the program really badly, those bad things will happen. If you run it well, with this much more questioning environment, much more rigorous European-led type approach, then I think you'll get a much better, much more exciting, much more interesting, much more impactful outcome.
Thank you, Brian. Father Matt.
Just trying to comment, I think some of the things I hear floating around the room and some reading of late is there is an issue, where is the why? Why are we bothering with immigrants? Why are we bothering doing it? I think that has to come from some discussion so that we can get energised by that why and get out there and do the job. In terms of the more isolated, I've been fortunate through the Shia Fund to be able to give religious in outlying parts of the UK money to look after Irish while they're doing the Vince DePaul work or while they're doing their parish work. And that has been very helpful. It's not formal, but it's working. But it's very hard to find somebody, A, who's Irish, and is involved at that level, and B, who's Irish and wants to do it. Because most of the people in those connections are actually interested in the broader society. And I just want to also to say about, you know, in terms of civil service, I mean, the civil servants, do they know about the immigrants? But you should find out the worries they have about their children who are living in San Diego or in Australia. Or, you know, I mean, it comes down to those basic things. But can I just sort of say, there's three phases in the development of an NGO with the government. And the first is they can't stand you. The second is they tolerate you. And the third is they need you. And I think with the evidence of today and like the Harvey Report, it's not a swipe at anyone. It's us saying, how do we respond to this in such a way that it's a dialogue, it's a learning, that we can all advance the care of immigrants. And that is the one wonderful thing. I mean, in any organisation, you get people who are burnt out before they ever go on fire. And, you know, but in terms of, in the civil service, when you find people who are committed to civil society and creating a good, harmonious society for the good of all, well, then you get that level of commitment that can move huge barriers. So I have found that, and I think we're mature enough in the immigrant world to realise now we're all working for the betterment of people, and what is the best structure to put in place, working with all the agents, civil service, church, individuals, NGOs, to move it on. And I think that's why I say the infrastructure is only now in place to actually begin the task. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much indeed, Alan and Brian. Time is ticking away and almost beating us, but we have two further speakers. Each of them has 10 minutes. You have a little sheet there, a bio as you came in. Our first speaker will be Noreen Bowden, our excellent Chief Executive Officer, and the second speaker will be Karen McHugh. You can read all about them on that sheet. So, Noreen.
Okay, I'm just going to spend a few minutes talking to you about our curriculum program. We are working on a curriculum to teach transition year history students about emigration and the Irish around the world. We finished stage one of the project, which was compiling a course outline, a set of exercises, and a comprehensive list of resources. And we're about to start stage two, which is I presented it to teachers at the History Teachers of Ireland Association conference in Tullamore in October, and again at the regional meeting last month. And so we have several teachers now who are interested in helping to pilot the project, just to give you an update on where we are. And I'm going to try to be fast. In terms of why we decided to do an emigration curriculum, as an organization, one of our missions is to help people understand the immigrant experience, and so we think it's a really important tool for helping people to understand the Irish abroad, particularly today's students who are likely to have less personal experience, even in their own families, with emigration. So it's important for us that they understand the experience. We think it's also useful, and understanding of migration is useful for understanding changing Ireland as well, because so much of the experience is in common, you know, across all sorts of cultures and times. Now, we had discussed in the beginning whether we would talk about preparation or should it just be purely historical, and it's a historical exercise, but some lessons do highlight the issues of preparation, just so you know. And one of the things that we found is that there's a tremendous lack of teaching resources. When I first started the project, I was amazed, actually, that there are very few resources that are usable by teachers. It's just, and many teachers are very, very interested in the topic, but they just don't have any way of teaching it. So that's one thing that we can do. Also, just to let you know, the task force report did call for information on the diaspora in schools. And they also say it, in turn, should lead to an understanding of multiculturalism. This is a quote from Canon Sheehan, who was actually a parish priest in Cove in the 1800s and early 1900s, who would have seen many people leaving as they emigrated. And I found this quote in a letter, actually. It's an unpublished letter. It's in the archives of Boston College. And peregrinari, peregrinari, the Irish have always been wanderers. It is the curse and the genius of our people. And I think that there's something about that, about the importance then of emigration in the Irish psyche. And I just thought it was an interesting quote. So it's one of the things I think that inspires me. We'll go just briefly through the goals. You can just take a look at them, really. It's just to gain an understanding and the effects of migration, develop an empathy, exploring the commonalities and the differences. So, okay? The guiding principles in developing the curriculum is to take advantage of the global resources. There are an awful lot of national archives of immigrant destination countries that have fabulous things up on the web. So it's compile those, highlight the best of them for teachers. We have an emphasis on primary documents so people can really get at the heart. You know, we're also... One of the things I really want to do is develop a lot of lively ideas for classroom exercises, and including a lot of sample exercises in the resource pack, so teachers can be encouraged to use them in innovative ways and do a lot of comparisons with different kinds of media and in different time periods as well. And again, we're very cooperative and we're working in association with teachers to develop the next stage of the project. In terms of what the curriculum itself covers, it really does cover the whole gamut of historical experience, from the early Irish missionaries, the flight of the earls and the wild geese, many of whom wound up serving in armies overseas or even doing things like running wineries throughout France and Spain. Early migration to the New World, which includes a lot about the Caribbean and North and South America, which is a topic that even a lot of teachers wouldn't know that much about. We found a lot of interest in that as well. Famine migration, some people already have units on famine migration, so that's already plugging into what they're doing already. Post-famine migration, and in the 20th century, where we're focusing on the 1950s and the 1980s, is the two times that they had the highest, that it was the most concentrated. In terms of the geography, again, it's pretty much the gamut of where Irish people would have gone historically. We've developed a few key questions, I don't have to go over these in detail, about what people should be looking for when they're analyzing the materials, things like push and pull factors, the relationship between people who left and people who stayed behind, what kind of reception people received when they arrived, how did they maintain their bond with Ireland, what distinguished the people who left from the people who stayed, how did the Irish people shape the cultures of the new lands, and again, what experiences are common to them all and which ones are specific to where they went and when they left. When it comes to the resources themselves, we're doing some traditional historical documents, but we're opening it up. We're also looking at journalist accounts for a more immediate, often more anecdotal approach to the materials. There's many emigrant diaries out there, tales of people's crossings, letters. Letters is actually a really important, fairly new area of research for people, and there's all sorts of collections coming out from many regions of the world in which Irish people study, and they're really fascinating. Film, we have, there's this fantastic documentary evidence actually from the 1950s in Britain, 1950s and 60s in Britain, as well as many other resources. That Rowick has actually done fabulous work on the Irish around the world, so their archives are very valuable to us. We're looking at art, which I'm actually going to show you some slides. So I just wanted to show you some of the more visually interesting things that we're using, political cartoons as well, memorials, oral histories. So now, I just wanted to show you it's less than a dozen images, I think. The first is two cartoons I'm going to show you offering very different opinions of Irish immigration. The first, this is around the time of the famine. It was published in Punch, which was a British newspaper, and it's called Here or There. Here and There, rather, or Immigration, a Remedy. And this would be a fairly common motif in depicting immigrants, is to show a before and after picture. Before, they're in poverty. Sometimes there's suggestions of indolence. And then when they arrive, there's plenty of food. You can tell that they're working hard because they have the shovel right there. So the suggestion is that they've entered land plenty. So, but now we have an alternate view, which was published. This is by an Irish nationalist newspaper in 1881. And you see there it says, now what it's showing is this woman represents Ireland and she's looking at the census data. And so she says, in 40 years I have lost, through the operation of no natural law, more than 3 million of my sons and daughters. And they, the young and the strong, leaving behind the old and the infirm to weep and to die. Where is this to end? So this is clearly a very different perspective that talks about the effect on what is this doing to Ireland. One of the interesting things I think about this is that it shows the ship off to the left-hand side of the frame, which is an extremely common way of depicting emigration. And I'll show you that in a few more pictures that are showing up. And here, there's devastation in the background. That's a cottage with no house. There's a woman there with her arms outraised as if she's asking for help. And then you just have the dry census data as well. So, and then I would just like to take art. There are not that many depictions of emigration in art, but the ones that are there are, I think, fairly interesting. So I'll just show you about half a dozen, I think. This one is called Outward Bound and Homeward Bound. And again, we see the same thing. The man is transformed. He has become prosperous. His clothes are better. Even his face. Now, Erskine Nicol is not someone who would have depicted the Irish in a terribly insulting manner generally, but he does look a little simian in the Outward Bound one, and he looks more regal, I think, in the second one. This one is called Letter from America, and it shows a young girl reading a letter, and you can tell the excitement that the family has in listening to her read. And so I just think it's bringing the emigrant's presence there in a very strong way. Okay. This one is called Emigrants at Cove. When I first saw this painting, it's from the 1930s. I didn't want to use it. I actually thought it was technically so substandard, really. You know, it's a little naive. It's like folk art, really, to me, in some ways. But then when I looked at it again, I realized it looks to me like it's a depiction of people waiting in line, perhaps to get on the boat. And when you see the stiltedness of it, people are not looking at each other. There's an awkwardness to it. And I think that it's sort of, it depicts an unease that I think the artist was actually probably trying to depict. And in the center, the way the man has his head bowed, and they're sort of, it's kind of circling around him. So I think it is actually, it's good at depicting that kind of emotion. This one is by one of Ireland's finest painters, Sean Keating. And there's so much to unpack in this picture. We'll just go very, very briefly. It looks to me like it's a man who's about to emigrate, saying goodbye to his mother. The men are uncomfortable with the scene. They look outwards. Now, what they are leaving is an extremely barren landscape. Even that dead tree up there, like the tree sort of made it, couldn't survive. And it's just gray and rocky. But if you see over by that ship again, here we see the ship off to the left, it's all bright. It's indicating that things are very bleak here, but there's hope beyond. So I just think it's a beautiful picture. This one is a very unsettling one, and it's from 1943, and I think what this depicts is an artist who's saying that, okay, there's nothing here, but if you look beyond at what they're going to, those rocks, they could look either like skyscrapers, perhaps, or they look like smokestacks, I think. And then, instead of a kind of, there is light over there, but it's not, it looks sort of unnatural, and that, the cloud formations actually could be smoke. You know, it could be. So I just think it's an indication of this. He's trying to say that things are very, very bad. And it's also called exiles, which is, again, indicating that even before they've left, they seem that they're exiled. This one is a photograph of people saying goodbye at Dublin Airport. It's by a woman who was herself an undocumented immigrant in the American Midwest in the 1980s. And what I like about this one is, even though so much has changed, the emotion is still there, and it's still very potent and very powerful. So, and that's it. I actually had a few more, but I'm just out of deference to the next speaker. I'm just going to end it there. So.
Thank you, Noreen. Yes.
Okay, thank you. It's lovely to be here just today to see so many familiar faces and also so many new faces, some that I saw yesterday at a conference yesterday in London on Irish traveller inclusion, which was an incredibly touching conference, very unrelated to the subject today, but I just wanted to say it's nice to see some people yesterday here again today. Okay, I've got the task of describing a very, very, very nice project that I've been involved in with Ian in the last kind of 6 months, and what I hope to take less than 10 minutes. So I just want to kind of go through the background first about the assisted holiday project. I was asked by the Immigrant Advice Network to actually do this piece of work over about a year period, to work between 3 and 5 holiday schemes to take a group of people over 60 from Britain, well, from England actually, to various parts of Ireland. It was developed as a pilot project, and as I said, between 3 and 5 schemes involving between 10 and 12 participants. For Ian or for myself to serve as a contact point between groups in Britain and groups in Ireland, to assist the groups in Ireland to coordinate a range of activities for the group arriving, and to produce a set of guidelines which would allow groups who would like to initiate an assisted holiday programmes, and to assist organisation and community groups in fundraising for these projects, and then to undertake a public launch and publicity campaign to champion the project. These are the tasks that I have been set to do and to achieve from about 6 months ago into for about another 6 months. Right, the background. Where did assisted holiday scheme originate? Why are we doing it now? The task force in 2002 that we've already heard described, which I'm not going to go into any detail, it recommends in section 6.18 that a holiday in Ireland scheme should be introduced to enable Irish elderly abroad, especially those in Britain who are unable to return permanently, to retain links with their family and friends in Ireland. It's recommended that a pilot scheme be set up in Britain and for it to be reviewed after 3 years with a view to the possibility of extending it to other countries. So what we're doing now is we're actually looking at this particular scheme may well be in the longer term pending funding. Obviously this new Goodbody report may have something to say about that, to pilot in other countries as well. So not just to focus on Britain. So that's, you know, one of the tasks we're going to set in this coming year. The second, really, which also comes down to funding in section 8.10, that there should be an allocation of funding targeted to assist in the Holiday in Ireland project for those who are not in a position to return home permanently. I think that's quite important. So we need to, you know, some thought was actually went into this, and there were recommendations that it should be funded. So we will be following up that as well. Okay, is there a need for assisted holiday projects? Yes, there is. And I've listed some of the needs or the reasons why. Many old people would love to have the opportunity to have a holiday, but they're unable to do it alone for a variety of different reasons. Some do not have the means to pay. Some are unable to travel alone for reasons of frailty or for other special needs. Others may find it too difficult or stressful or be nervous to go alone. Some have lost contact with relatives and have no place to stay. Because of this such strong sense of pride, many want to go back, but to be independent of their relatives. Many would like to have emotional and practical support of a worker, because some of the people that we actually are taking on holidays have a variety of needs. And to have a worker there in the background who can actually talk through some of those very, very strong emotions, which I will talk about in a few minutes, that is really important for some people. Also to actually holiday in a group setting, to have something in common, you know, to have a group experience of a group of migrants actually returning home, you know, their experience of what it was like when they left, and they're all going back together. I think that really is really important as well. And I suppose one of the other main reasons why there is a need for a assisted holiday project is that for a lot of people, and we've already heard this morning, do not want to come back to live in Ireland permanently for also a variety of reasons. And some people equally have tried to come back, and some people have come back. And one member of our group, which I will talk about in a couple of minutes, came back to live in Ireland. It didn't work. And went back again to England and had to start all over again. So I think the idea of having a holiday is really, really quite important. And for many of the people, because it's over 60, 65 at least, and some would be quite a bit older, it may be their last chance to actually come home alive. Okay, now I want to talk about our first holiday, which was a tremendous success. It only happened in October of this year to Monaghan, and I call it Monaghan Experience. It was hosted by the Clonus Community Forum in Monaghan in partnership with the London Irish Centre and other centres as well, but that was what the formal arrangement was. We took 8 people back. Most had not been back for a minimum of 5 years, and most of the people came from Monaghan or the surrounding counties. Okay, some of the outcomes and highlights. And this is when it gets quite emotional, because it was a very, very emotional week. And fortunately, Noreen, who's here, spent quite a bit of time. Mary came up as well from Mayo. One member had not been home for 25 years. His wife died 25 years ago. And he came back. I probably should have only hid some of those. That's exactly what I'd do, because you're all cheating now. Why can't you even do that? I should have done the other one, the one that jumps. Okay, that's right. Don't look now. Don't cheat, please. Because you take the emotion out of it if you do. Okay, one member had not been back for 25 years. He lost his wife 25 years ago, and he came back for the first time, hadn't been in a plane, hadn't seen or heard from his relatives in Ireland in Enniskillen for 25 years. The anniversary of his wife was actually the day we got there, and she was also buried in Enniskillen. It was an incredibly emotional reunion. I went out for coffee with, I think, Mary. No, it wasn't actually. It was, yes, and more. Three of us went out for coffee. The second day, I think we were there, and he hadn't been in touch with his family. So I said, well, okay, who have you been in touch with? And he said, sister in England. So I said, well, why don't you ring the sister, and then maybe you can get your brother's number in Enniskillen. And he said, no. And we persuaded him in as positive a way as possible. And it wasn't forceful or coercive, now, I have to say. But equally, we were going to Enniskillen that night to a country and western concert in the theatre. And I just thought, sometimes you just have to encourage people, you know, and not force them, but just positively encourage. And he agreed, and he rang his brother. We got to the theatre, and we had arranged a reunion. And it was an emotional reunion after 25 years when the brother came to see him. And it was very awkward. There was no big hugs. It was like they wanted to hug, they wanted to embrace, but it was that sense of, oh, God, you know, what do I do? So what the outcome of that, his brother took him out again another day, and they spent the whole day visiting his sister-in-law, his nieces and nephews that he never saw before, and to the extent that, you know, he now has regular contact. And it was a very... This is how the holiday scheme can work. Another person hadn't been back for 48 years. He had been adopted in the area of Lisdoonan near Carrickmacross. We took him to his village, and that was actually on our way back to Dublin. And it was also incredibly emotional. We took photographs of the sign of his village, Lisdoonan, and he met a cousin, a grand cousin or something, when we went to the shop, and they had a chat. Now, he's gone back. He's planning his holiday to go back next March to reconnect with his family, which, after 48 years, a huge outcome. Another member hadn't been back for 15 years. She had a sister. She didn't know if the sister was still alive or not, and hadn't had any contact with the other family for some time. We reunited her with her family. She met her sister, who lives in a nursing home, and she's over 90, I'm not sure exactly what age, but the whole extended family were reconnected, and she's 88, and she had been the victim of a very, very serious burglary a couple of months ago, and she had been stabbed, and her face had been cut and everything. So the holiday for her was a double bonus of just getting away from everything and reconnecting with her family. I was kind of compared to, who was it, Cilla Black or something like that, Fairy Godmother. We had quite a few reunions that were surprises, and some of the surprises were we went to Oma, to the American Folk Park, and I had arranged one of the other members who's from Donegal, I'd arranged for her sister. I gave everyone my mobile number, all the people who, I said, if you want to give it to anyone, that's fine. So her sister rang me And quietly, I kind of arranged for her to come up and meet us at OMA American Folk Park, but I said nothing. So we got off the minibus, this woman, like, you know, there was this emotional reunion, and they were just, it was just amazing. And a few days later, then her sisters, her three sisters, came up for a night, and, you know, tears. I've never seen, and I've never experienced, as Noreen as well, tears than we did for that kind of emotional reunion. Another were two brothers who came from Sligo, where I come from as well, and that's no connection how they came from Sligo, but they had been home about a couple of years ago for a funeral, but before that hadn't been home in excess of 15 years. I also arranged for their sister to come all the way up from Sligo. I think she had to get about three buses, and then she had to get a taxi, and we arranged a surprise, a total surprise. I took her in, hid behind me all the way into American Folk Park in OMA, and I had everyone waiting. Everyone else kind of knew at this stage, so she just arrived, and it was like, you know, it was just brilliant. And then another one of the other people, she visited her family near Clonus. She had, as I said, had come back to live in Ireland, and it didn't work. And she had no desire to ever come back to live in Ireland, but the holiday experience was what she wanted and what meant so much to her. She was incredibly secure in herself that she didn't have this longing of, oh, I want to go home, I want to return. She was quite happy where she was, and not having that desire of wanting to live. Most other members who came all are possibly considering, some very strongly considering coming back, and some will come back, and some it will be the right decision. Some others, I think, need to do a lot of work before they, if they do come back, they need to know, make sure it's the right thing. And that's where I think, you know, having maybe even temporary break in your tenancy to hold on to your place, if that's possible. But that's not, you know, not part of the holiday scheme, so I'm not going to go into that. It really worked, the Monaghan experience, and I suppose this other organisation, I said it was London Irish Centre, but also the Safe Home Scheme, and a number of other Irish centres that I contacted in Britain as well, or in London, who referred people, but for various reasons they weren't either suitable or didn't work, but certainly the Safe Home Scheme and the London Irish Centre came up with the members, and I want to thank them both, and I suppose particularly Maureen Higgins, who did a lot of background work as well. So it worked. So the first one was a major success. Every single other scheme, it's a lot to live up to. Okay, what worked well? Because I think we need to, you know, evaluate, and we're talking about performance indicators and monitoring, etc. You have to look at what worked well, but what equally we need to do better the next time. I don't like to say what didn't work, because it's about room for improvement, doing it better. Okay, there was excellent planning by the host group. The Monaghan Community, or Clonus Community Forum, had a fantastic programme planned of events for the whole week. Every day was structured and planned. The accommodation was lovely, the food was excellent. Most participants were from the Monaghan and surrounding counties. I think that is really important. That, you know, there is that local connection. You can do all these surprises. You can do all this travelling. You can visit people. You can connect people. If someone's like from Cork coming up to Monaghan, fine if they just want a holiday. But the whole scheme is that kind of reconnection, and I think that works that worked really well. The group had, most of them hadn't met before. They gelled. It was absolutely just amazing how everyone got on so well, and we had fantastic fun. There was a lot of emotions, but we had several parties and it was brilliant. The holiday was fully funded through a grant for the Department of Social and Foreign Affairs. That obviously worked well, because that meant we didn't have to go looking for money and sponsorships as well. Okay, areas for improvement, conscious of time. Longer period of time required for the planning. Now, it's kind of, I might contradict myself and saying, like, it was planned for a long time, but there was no confirmation of funding until, I think, July, and the holiday was going to be in October. There was a whole month of August when practically everything closes down. So there was a period where, you know, we had about six, eight weeks to plan a holiday. And that's working with people who are vulnerable, who are older, who are in need, who had several hospital appointments, doctor's appointments, you name it. You know, if there was maybe a lot longer notice, some could have rearranged or rescheduled, but sometimes you have to wait for months for appointments and you're reluctant to actually change. Or even someone was getting a new kitchen, they wouldn't go because they were getting a new kitchen. So I think longer period of time formal time from agreeing it's happening and agreeing the days, I think 2 months, 8 weeks is not enough. Less strict criteria for the holiday. We set very, very strict criteria, so I think that didn't overly work. And I'll tell you why it didn't work, because when we couldn't, the criteria were you not being back for a minimum of 5 years, be from the local area, be over 65. The main part that didn't work was not being back for a minimum of 5 years. Fine, we got people who were not back maybe for 25 years or 50 years, but from the same area, from Monaghan, who were not back for 5 years, who were older, who were living in Camden, very, very tight criteria. Hence, about 3 weeks before, we didn't have enough members. So we had to go and rush panic. And there was panic. Everyone was panicking, I have to say. But I knew it would happen. So I think to be a little bit more flexible with the next project, it would mean it would be a little bit more of a success. More than, not even just a success, but it would make it easier. I think it's very important for people to contribute towards the cost of the trip and activities, because money's not always the biggest issue or the biggest problem at that period of time. People equally can actually, you know, start putting a certain amount of money away each week over a period of months. And the whole idea of not paying, I people want to contribute something, and I think it's also about value, you know, valuing yourself. You know, it's important to contribute. And people also fed that back. Have one or two drop-off points and collection points. That's only because we had several issues around that, and I won't go into those, but next time there'll only be one, possibly two. Earlier flight times back to the UK. We had a major disaster and catastrophe when we got back. One of the members had lost her key or didn't have her key, and we had to get her into a sheltered housing block and couldn't find keys and to wait for an hour or two. Another member then refused to get her own way home because we wasted so much time with someone else. And so we were driving around like for something like 3 hours, dropping. And so next time, earlier flight, 1 point or 2 points only, because everyone actually agreed to meet at 1 point. But when it came to coming home, and I think that, you know, the message for me was that people weren't ready. They didn't want to leave because it was a very, very cosy, comfortable, warm, welcoming, fun group. And, you know, there's some kind of ambivalence, I feel, or I felt at the time. You know, maybe going back to that lonely, sheltered housing scheme where this person does not want to be and feels very unhappy there. You know, did she have the key or not? Did she not want to go back or not, should I say? Okay, the group to meet a few times before they go on holiday. I think that might be quite important. It worked well and everyone gelled, but that may not be the case in the next one. Okay, what's next? Three holiday schemes planned next year, and it is brilliant that we have one of the participants of the host community here, which is Sister Tracta in Port Arlington. And I've said the awfully holiday. Sounds awfully, but awfully holiday. And that's in partnership with the Lee. Sorry? Oh, yeah, sorry, it is actually. Port Arlington, it's Port Arlington. And I should know, because I've lived in Leash. Well. Okay. My geography or history isn't too good. So we have planned provisional days, 7th to the 12th of May, for that particular holiday, and we're going to be working with the Huddersfield Irish community. And I've had quite a few discussions, and we'll have a lot more with Sister Tracta in planning that. Kerry, we are working with Kerry Rural Resettlement Project. Have had a couple of meetings already, a number of conversations this week. Unfortunately, the main person is not well at the moment, so we're not able to kind of do much until January in terms of confirmation, but that's going to be in March. Spoke to the Luton Irish Centre, who are quite keen, and possibly we look at Leeds, because I think it's quite important to be outside London. You know, all the Irish community do not live in London. Hence, we're going to Huddersfield, Luton, maybe Leeds, possibly Sandwell. Siobhan, you're here. Talk nicely to me at lunch. Or bribe me. And the holiday in Clare is going to be in April. So that is within Kilrush, Kilkee. And that's with a group that we've already met and had conversations. And we've a provisional date of the 14th to 21st of April. And that's the three holidays, possibly more, but it's between three and five, so we've got four, so we have room for a fifth. To launch a set of guidelines for the assisted holiday project. That's something there's been a bit of work done, I know more in the Safe Home, and there's been obviously a lot of work done with A and separately. So I'm also looking at some other kind of brochures as well, maybe through other projects who do holidays, although they don't have formal guidelines. And I've done kind of Google searches for brochures just to see, you know, what works elsewhere. Has it worked? Rather than just reinventing and doing it all again, use current models. So that will be, I'm not sure, definitely be in the next couple of months we'll have that kind of ready. Definitely before the next holiday, well in advance of the next holiday. And that's it, really. So it was a great success, and it's a privilege to have been involved. I just really just want to read out. I asked each member to write their experience, what it meant for them, and we had 8 letters, and some were incredibly emotional, which I wouldn't read out because they're a bit too emotional, but I thought I'd just read maybe a little bit of this one. On the 10th of October, a group of us met in the Irish Centre in Camden. Through the expert planning of people from both sides of the water, an unforgettable trip to Clonus and County Monaghan was arranged for people who had not been home for quite some time. Few of us knew each other prior to the day of departure, but we all got on extremely well together and we all returned as good friends. The welcome we received was wonderful, and our stay was the best holiday I ever had. Every day was planned for us, and everything we did was carried out with us in mind. Some of the things we'd done were a visit to a country and western show, an American folk park, Monaghan Museum, Glass Lock, Castle Leslie, and many more trips. One of the organisers played fairy godmother on several occasions when she got people to meet up with members of families who had not seen each other for several years. Members of my own family joined me one night before our departure. I was reluctant to make contact, but with a little persuasion, it was something I will never forget. On the whole, it was the best holiday I ever had. That sums it up, and that's all I'm going to say. So thank you very much for it.
Thank you very much indeed, Karen. Fascinating presentation. Thank you, Noreen. Most interesting. I just wrote down, I'm very brief, all the facts this morning, all the emotion this morning. I want to thank all the speakers. Thank you all for your attention. I was going to say father time, that's sexist. Father and mother time beats us all the time when we're in discussions like this. It's time for lunch. Enjoy your lunch, and we'll see you back here afterwards. Thank you.
Nice, just next door there, when you go outside...